Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It has been 20 years since today's guest, Dan Buettner, discovered the Blue Zones, the five places in the world where people live the longest. Dan Buettner returned to these places to produce a four-part series for Netflix, which you can watch online now. It is called Live to 100, Secrets of the Blue Zones. He wanted to find out what has and hasn't changed in those places. He discovered new insights about the power of purpose, faith, community, downtime, movement, and plant-based eating. He also found that the Blue Zones have changed, mostly because of modernization and the devastating impact of American food culture. He also discovered a brand new Blue Zone in Singapore, where policies like housing and healthcare for all have created a nationwide community of longevity and wellness. The extensive notes he took about his latest trip and the 30 or so trips he's taken over the years inspired his new book, The Blue Zones, Secrets for Living Longer. Dan Buettner is the founder of Blue Zones, an organization that helps Americans live longer, healthier, happy lives. Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for joining us again.
It's a delight to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. It is amazing to think that your first piece of work on longevity came out in 2005, and that's when you wrote the National Geographic cover story, The Secrets of Long Life. And then since then, you've gone on to write four best-selling books. I mean, what a journey this has been for you.
I'm hard-pressed to think of a better professional life than traveling the world on National Geographic expense account and learning insights on how to live longer and better. It's a wonderful journey. I'm still on it.
You're still on it. And I think the thing that I love the most is that you have been able to spend time with so many people around the world who have lived to 100 or even 105. I mean, that must have been every meeting must have been amazing.
There's something really special about meeting somebody with three digits in their age. But you know, the way we tell stories in National Geographic, many years of the work occurs even before I book a flight. You know, we were aggregating the available scientific studies that explain why these populations are living a long time. It took us 2.5 years just to do the demographic work to be able to say with confidence that Sardinia, Italy, Okinawa, Japan, Nicoya, Costa Rica, Ikaria, Greece, and among the Adventists in Loma Linda, California, are the statistically longest-lived people. You really have to get that right, and that's a big demographic job. And then once you find that, to find the common denominators, and then you know the way you tell the story is you kiss a lot of frogs until you find that prince or princess who is 100, but also follows the lifestyle of the region. So by profiling that individual, you tell the bigger story of the place and the bigger story of longevity. But yes, it's all fun.
Can you talk more about how you went about proving that? Because you have worked with so many doctors and scientists and researchers. And here we have this gorgeous book with these beautiful photos, but so much went on, as you said, behind the scenes.
So I collaborate with a demographer, a Belgian demographer named Michel Poulon, and a Sardinian demographer slash physician, actually, named Gianni Pess. And the three of us have really done most of the work on identifying the blue zones. But the process involves going back about 100 years to a swath of births, say, between 1920 and 1925, and following those births for 100 years. And then you adjust for immigration and emigration, people coming in and people leaving. And then you see how many people are still alive. So it's a straight mathematical formula for the most part. And, you know, the places we double check birth records and cross check them against baptismal records, because so many places like the Hunza Valley and the Vilcabamba Valley of Ecuador and the Caucasus have been rumored to be long lived. But they weren't. People were lying about their ages, or they didn't know their ages. So you can't draw any meaningful conclusions on longevity in places where people actually don't live a long time. So we worked hard to get that right.
What has it been like for you to do all of this research and then looking at the data in the United States? Loma Linda is the one blue zone in the U.S., and that's in Southern California. But when you look at the data in the U.S., even though we have so much information now, it's still pretty dire. I mean, according to the CDC's official numbers, you've got 6 in 10 adults in the U.S. with a chronic disease, 4 in 10 adults in the U.S. with 2 or more chronic diseases.
And 75% of us are obese or overweight, and that's almost triple than it was in 1980. And 660,000 Americans die every year prematurely from a chronic disease. Most of it is food driven. So we don't pay attention to this, but we've lost many times more Americans to the standard American diet than we've lost to wars since the Civil War. And if we put as much money in our preventative efforts or to help Americans eat healthier, we'd save way more. I mean, if we had a budget even remotely comparable to our military budget, I know it's slightly an apples and oranges thing, but we could probably save a couple $1 trillion a year off of our healthcare costs and save 500,000 lives every year, but we don't do it.
I mean, I think you make a good point because we talk about that a lot on this show. I mean, the last military budget is either 860 or 880 billion, a massive amount of money. And yet, it was so interesting reading the section on Singapore and just being so envious because, as you know, so many of the problems in this country are the lack of access to healthy food, lack of healthcare, lack of safe housing, lack of education for so many people. I mean, the list is just so long at this point.
Yes, well, some of that is true. I don't actually buy the lack of healthy food or lack of access to healthy food. We've been marketed this idea that you have to have fresh veggies to be healthy, but you don't. People in blue zones are eating mostly peasant food, like beans and rice and beans and corn tortilla. And I don't know if you've been to a grocery store lately, even convenience stores, you can buy a bag of beans for a couple bucks a pound. So a little bit of it is we're taking aim at the wrong thing. But you're right. I mean, people who own their own homes live longer than people who don't. It's just a correlation. But in Singapore, 85% of people or so own their own homes, and we have nowhere near that in the United States. And that's because the government has made it easy for people to own homes rather than just, let property developers sort of market us rental units. And education, I would say arguably the most important thing a country could do to increase healthy life expectancy is make sure that women of childbearing age are educated because they tend to have fewer children who are better educated, who are healthier, who grow up to be more productive and make better voting decisions. So you get this upward ratcheting of quality of life by making the strategically correct investments. And that's what Singapore has done.
So let's talk about Singapore. And I do want to ask you, because I'm sure listeners are wondering, I think you make a good point, because when I talk about food, I'm thinking about the $8 strawberries that I just saw at my natural food store the other day, things that are just ridiculously expensive that most people cannot afford. But when you go to the bulk section, you do have lentils, beans, rice, so many other foods that are a couple dollars. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
If you come to my website, danbuehner.com, there's a recipe for a Sardinian minestrone. In fact, I just made a pot of it this morning. It's beans, it's a couple potatoes, it's a can of tomatoes, stewed tomatoes, small can of two stewed tomatoes, an onion, a carrot, piece of celery. It makes 10 servings and it costs under a dollar. This is the exact same meal that the longest lived family in the history of the world ate. And 9 siblings who collective age was 861 years. So this is a meal cost a dollar per person. It takes about 20 minutes to assemble, put it in an Instapot, hit a button or a pressure cooker on top of your stove. And you're getting half the fiber you need for the day. You're getting a huge dose of protein, because whenever you have a bean and a grain, you have all the protein you need. And canned foods are just fine, especially if you're, you know, you can't afford the fresh strawberries or the fresh tomatoes. Canned or frozen food is just fine. It's just that we're sort of misguided that we need superfoods, or you know, we have to go to the boutique grocery with the freshest vegetables. It's nice to get fresh vegetables. Yes. But you get 90 or 95% the way to a healthy diet by giving people beans and rice and then flavoring them to your culture, whether it's, you know, Hoppa John for African Americans, or minestrone or pasta and fagioli for the Mediterranean people, or black beans and corn tortilla, fabulous, fabulous meal. Or peanut butter and on whole wheat bread sandwiches. That's a bean and a grain. And they're all just cheap. Everybody can afford them. They're quick to make. And I just don't buy the cop out that, you know, we don't have access to healthy food, because we do.
And you have so many of these recipes on your website, the Blue Zone site.
Well, it's actually danbuehner.com.
Okay. Well, we've got a link at our website. So let's dive in and talk about the brand new Blue Zone. First off, how do you discover new Blue Zones? What's the process?
Well, I was careful at labeling this a 2.0, but I always begin with evidence-based. So the original Blue Zones, it was the consortium between the three of us, the demographer, the researcher who found the first Blue Zone, and me. And but the, you know, the papers are always peer reviewed. You know, you can find the papers, the academic papers that were written when we first discovered these Blue Zones. The Singapore is a little different approach. You know, we went to the World Health Organization and found that they were producing the longest lived healthy people in the world. And it's a small island, so it's geographically contained. It meets all the profile. But what we liked mostly about it was that it's a manufactured Blue Zone. When I was a little kid, Singapore was a fishing village. And in one lifetime, you know, there's 5.5 million people there. It's one of the richest places on earth per capita. People, you know, I wrote a cover story for National Geographic in 2018 about happiness. They report the highest level of life satisfaction in all of Asia. And now to find they're producing about a dozen good years of healthy life expectancy for people. It has all the characteristics of a Blue Zone. But what makes this interesting is they're modern. It's not some ancient culture. It was a bunch of well-educated people with a set of good values who got put in government, and they prioritized people's health over business interests and produced a manifestly healthier place.
And it's half the size of Rhode Island, just to give people a sense of the size. And again, home to 5.5 million people. So you write that in 1960, the average newborn in Singapore could expect to live only 65 years. Now, one lifetime later, life expectancy has grown by almost 20 years. Of all the nations in the world, it ranked number one in 2019 for life expectancy at birth, almost 85 years, which is six more than the U.S. They've got the world's lowest rate of cardiovascular mortality and the best healthcare system. So tell us more about that. How did they manage to do that?
Well, okay, so there's universal access to healthcare, and it's controlled by the government, by a business interest as much. So you go into a hospital there, it looks like a Four Seasons, and everybody has access in it. But you have to work. I mean, you have to pay for your hospital visit. It's just affordable. So that's one. But I actually don't think that the hospital or the healthcare system is as important as we think. We live in a country where it's, you know, we spend $4.4 trillion a year, and the 97% of it is in trying to mop up the problem after it's occurred. Singapore has had the courage to, for example, subsidize healthy food like brown rice, and tax unhealthy food like foreign candy. They've had the courage to stand up against the beverage associations and the beverage companies and limit the amount of sugar in soda pop. So a Coke in Singapore has 20% less sugar than a Coke in the UK.
Wow.
They realized very early on that traffic was a public health burden. It creates pollution. The more traffic you have, the more accidents, the more little kids get killed every year, the more time people spend behind their wheel as opposed to being on their feet. So they tax cars and gasoline very heavily. A car costs you about triple of what it costs in the United States. But they've taken the surplus and they spent it on beautiful walkways, parks. Most of this tiny island is covered with trees and gardens. They have a efficient, fast, safe, and beautiful public transportation system, subway that is no more than 300 yards from anybody's house.
Wow.
And though only 10% or 11% of Singaporeans own cars, everybody gets to where they want to go, but they get there walking a few hundred yards every time they go someplace. So as a result, their BMI is a fraction of the obesity rate is a fraction of that of the United States. We have to get away from continuing to beat this dead horse of exercise, which is marketed to us, but it's been an unmitigated public health failure. Fewer than 23% of Americans get the minimum even of 20 minutes of physical activity a day. So we keep spending billions or hundreds of billions of dollars in exercise. It doesn't work. What works is a walkable city.
Well, and I love this part of Singapore. As you write in your book, one of the most popular new ideas was the National Steps Challenge, which turned exercise into a game. Anyone who logged 10,000 steps a day on their mobile device qualified for health points that they could redeem for vouchers to spend at restaurants, movies, or public transportation, among other options. Now in its eighth year, the challenge has attracted more than 1.7 million people to take part. I mean, that's amazing.
It's the right idea. Yeah, I had to include it. I think that it's fun to gamify things, and it seems to be working in Singapore. I'm more of in favor, and this is what we see in the original Blue Zone, and what it mostly attracted me to Singapore is they're not trying to get people to change their behavior, which is a long-term failure for almost all the people, almost all the time. But they've changed the environment so that people's unconscious decisions are a little bit better all day long. And when you add that up over years and decades and a lifetime, it shows up as an extra dozen good years and a fraction of the rate of the diseases that we suffer here in the United States.
You interviewed Lee Kuan Yew, the man widely regarded as Singapore's founding father, and that was in 2009. Can you just talk about the thinking behind all of this? Because, okay, sure, the United States, what is it? What is our population now, about 340 million? I mean,
yes.
California is 42 million, you know, larger than most countries. So what would it take, do you think, to translate this kind of policy? Because I love how you say that. You cannot change people by saying, all right, you just need to walk more. Go out and do 10,000 steps. But to create an environment that makes it fun. And in the case of Singapore, it sounds beautiful, these open spaces. Because I'm afraid, Dan, if we keep going down this road, I mean, I've got so many sick people in my own family. You know, it's hard to reach even your own loved ones.
I say if you're unhealthy and overweight in this country, it's probably not your fault. Mm. And as evidence, I offer to you the obesity rate in 1980, which was one third of what it is today. And the number of people who were diabetic or pre-diabetic in 1980 was about one seventh. Now, is that because people in 1980 had greater sense of individual responsibility, or they were more disciplined or smarter than we are? No, we're like a frog in water that's about to start boiling. You know, we're not jumping out, but just our environment is just getting more and more lethal, and we let it happen. And you know, the lobbyists in Washington, they have more sway than the sort of little known policies like the ones that Singapore has adopted that we know work. And they're inconvenient for business interests, but they sure are good for human interests.
Right. Well, and that also speaks to the gun policy in Singapore. Guns are strictly illegal there. No one except the police and military can own them. As you point out, in 2021, 57,000 people in the U.S. died of gun violence. In Singapore, the number was just 3.
And that was a big year. It was down to 1 year last year. One wow. person dying. So I mean, if you're actually a policymaker motivated by data, by human lives and safety and security, the clear choice is to make gun ownership illegal. Now, I know there's all these sort of freedom issues and political issues around gun ownership, but you know, we probably lose a quarter to a third of your life expectancy by our national choice to arm our citizens. Mm-hmm. Similarly, drugs. You know, in Singapore, they're very hard on drugs, especially opiates. If you get caught with more than 15 grams, you could be put to death.
Wow.
And that seems draconian and it seems medieval. But in the United States last year, 110,000 Americans lost their lives to drug overdoses. And in Singapore, the number was about 25. So once again, you know, if you're a policymaker, and I'm not for or against, quite honestly, I'm not. But if you're looking at the data and, you know, as Thomas Jefferson said, that the charge of any politician is to maximize the health and happiness of the citizens. You know, you're sort of obligated to look at these numbers and have them influence you.
Right. I appreciate what you say, though, about how so much of this is really not an individual's fault, because the cities were not designed, most cities were not designed to be near public transportation like you found in Singapore, or to be near the things that people need on a regular basis, or to be walkable, for example. I think it was Oklahoma City I visited once, and in some parts of the city, there were no sidewalks, so people couldn't even go on walks.
That's a big indicator. By the way, Singapore was a crush of traffic in the 1970s. So they're like Los Angeles today or San Francisco. I mean, they made the decision
right
to make it more walkable. And by the way, you guys in San Francisco did a fantastic job with the Embarcadero, which used to be a double-decker freeway, and it collapsed. And instead of building another concrete behemoth, you built this beautiful walkable area that raised the quality of life in a big chunk of San Francisco.
Right. So it's political will. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we are speaking with Dan Buettner, the founder of Blue Zones, an organization that helps Americans live longer, healthier, happier lives. Dan Buettner first discovered the Blue Zones back in 20 years ago, the 5 places in the world where people live the longest. He returned to these places to produce a 4-part series for Netflix, which you can watch online. It is called Live to 100, Secrets of the Blue Zones. He kept extensive notes about that trip and then the 30 or so trips he's taken over the years, which have inspired his brand new book called The Blue Zones, Secrets for Living Longer. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your
59917. Let's get back to Rose's conversation. Thanks.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Dan Buettner, founder of Blue Zones, an organization that helps Americans live longer, healthier, happier lives. 20 years ago, Dan discovered the Blue Zones, 5 places in the world where people live the longest. He has discovered a new Blue Zone. We were just talking about Singapore, where policies like housing and healthcare for all have created a nationwide community of longevity and wellness. Dan is out with a new book, The Blue Zones, Secrets for Living Longer. He's also got a 4-part series for Netflix, which you can watch now. It's called Live to 100, and we'll have Dan back in a couple of months to talk more about the series. Dan, before we talk about some of the other blue zones and what you found 20 years later, I wonder what it's like for you, because you probably travel more than most people. And just what a gift it is to see new places, to meet such a wide range of people. And I wonder what goes through your mind knowing that people are doing it, that like in Singapore, healthcare for all, walkable cities, you know, incentives. And then you come back to the US and I mean, not, of course, there are healthy cities and so many amazing aspects of the US. You've actually created blue zones in the US. But what is that experience like, just knowing that we could be doing so much better?
Well, rather than throwing my arms up, I actually did something. In 2009, I got a grant from AARP, and we went about manufacturing a blue zone, a blue zone project city here in the United States. And the core insight from all these blue zones, sure, they tell us you should eat a plant-based diet, and sure that you should have a sense of purpose, and that's important, and be socially connected. But most of that, I realized, is driven not by behavior modification or trying to educate people or hound or incent people or wag your finger at people, but by reshaping their environment so you set them up for success. You're making the healthy choices easy, salient, and cheap and attractive. And so instead of shifting, so that means shifting the mindset quite a bit from the way things are done in public health. And that involved, you know, it turns out with a little bit of research, you can find about 30 or so food, built environment, and tobacco policies that occasion greater health. So we put those in menus, we call it. We go into cities, and when we get hired to blue zone a city, we work with city council to find a consensus about which of those policies are effective in their community. We don't tell them which ones. So that's, you know, we sort of sidestep the nanny state kind of accusation, and then which ones are politically feasible. And it turns out that in every city we work in, we find probably 20 or 25 policies that are easy win, that city government can enact quickly. You don't have to go through the machinations in the federal government level, and we can pretty quickly change the policy environment so that people, it's easier for the pedestrian than the motorist, and it's cheaper to eat healthier foods and more accessible than junk foods. And the non-smoker is favored over the smoker. And the second part of our program involves certifying restaurants, grocery stores, workplaces, schools, and churches. In the 5 years we usually stay in a city, we can usually get about 30% of those places certified, and all they're doing is changing their policies and their designs so people are unconsciously nudged into moving more, eating better, socializing more, and knowing and living out their purpose. And that makes it huge. So we're not trying to aim a silver bullet. We unleash a healthy swarm of silver buckshot. Each little intervention may have a quarter or half a percent influence on the behavior of a population. But when you add it all up, in every single city we worked at, Gallup finds that we improve health, improve a life satisfaction, and drop healthcare costs. And that's taking right from the lessons I learned from places like Sardinia and Okinawa.
So let's talk about an example you chose in 2008. Is it Albert Lea, Minnesota?
Albert Lea chose itself. The first mistake people make is going in and bestowing the blue zone wisdom upon them. No, we audition cities, and they have to show they really want us, and they're ready to make some changes and they have the tolerance, because at the end of the day, we are making healthy choices easier and necessarily making unhealthy choices harder. So, you know, somebody who's very dogmatic might say, well, you know, you're limiting our freedoms to do unhealthy stuff. Yeah, we are guilty. And if you want really easy, unhealthy stuff, you call the wrong number. So
Albert.
But anyway, Albert Lea was first place. Yeah.
So this is a community of 18,000 people. And again, just to really improve public policies, you all as a community developed a policy bundle to improve the walkability and bikeability of Albert Lea, slowly transform the city's street designs from car friendly to people friendly. You put together a school program that favored healthy foods over junk foods, persuaded restaurants and grocery stores to make healthy foods easier to find and more enticing to eat. And this is amazing. So you introduced a Blue Zones pledge for individuals and enrolled 25% of the city's adult population into volunteering and taking workshops on how to pursue their sense of purpose. And then people just spread the word and then others are interested in learning more. Is that how it works?
Well, you're skimming the surface. But there's, yes, we have a people program. We try to get them to reshape their social networks, their social immediate social circles, because if you hang out with people who smoke and sit around and eat hot dogs and drink, you know, sodas, guess what you're going to be doing? Meanwhile, if you hang out with people whose idea of recreation is walking or playing pickleball or eating healthy, that is measurably contagious. So a big part of what we try to do is re-curate people's social circles. We do give them a purpose workshop, but the key is then getting them volunteering, because volunteering tends to be addictive, and that becomes long-term. And then we give them checklists to go into their homes to optimize their kitchens in their homes. So they unconsciously consume 100 fewer calories and unconsciously burn a couple hundred extra calories a day. And there's where you get the power, because people don't have to remember things.
Right. And according to the book, as data gathered by Gallup showed, you raised the life expectancy of the average citizen by 3 years and shaved about 30% off the city's year-over-year healthcare bill. And that was over the course of 18 months?
Yes, and they continue to be on the program today. They're still wow. Blue Zone City.
Amazing. So, and since
then... We always hire Gallup to measure. That way, you know, it's not just us saying, yeah, look how great we are. If Gallup measures 18 different facets of the city's health, and at the end of each year, usually we've learned since Albert Lea that we really need to be in a city about 5 years to really make a difference, especially a bigger city like Fort Worth. We're now in Jacksonville, Florida, and Scottsdale, Arizona. And that you know, as you can imagine, these bigger cities take longer to reshape.
Right. So at this point, you're in about 72 cities across the U.S.?
We've been in 72. We're probably active in about 20 cities. But that's over the last 15 years.
Wow. Well, today we are speaking with Dan Buettner about his new book, The Blue Zones, Secrets for Living Longer, Lessons from the Healthiest Places on Earth. Well, let's go back to some of the Blue Zones, Dan. How about, why don't we talk a little bit about Okinawa? I always find this place so interesting because of the history, but then also because of the U.S. military having a major footprint there. Okinawa is home to 55,000 U.S. military personnel. And then as you report, Okinawan women have been the longest lived in the world with a life expectancy of about almost 88 years, 7 years more than American women. So tell us about when you first discovered Okinawa and why people there were so healthy.
Yeah, I should be clear that it was Craig and Bradley Wilcox, the Mayo Clinic Harvard team that discovered it in the 90s, but I included it in our Blue Zones, but I did write about it as early as 1999. And, you know, they did produce the longest lived people in the history of the world. And some of the things that help explain it is they were eating a 98% whole food plant-based diet. Until about 1970, two-thirds of the caloric intake came from purple sweet potatoes, Emo, Benny Emo. That's all they ate that every day. And it's a very healthy food. Probably eight times more tofu than we eat. Turmeric figures very prominently. There's lots of studies on the health benefits of turmeric. That's the yellow you see in curry. But also, you know, we now know that loneliness is as bad as a smoking habit in America. 25% of us report being lonely. But in Okinawa, from a very early age, people are put into or self-select these MOAIs, M-O-A-I, MOAI, which is a committed social circle, a sort of pod of people who travel through life together and support each other. So you don't get lonely people in traditional Okinawa, or it's very rare anyway. Also, interestingly, one of the most dangerous years of our lives is the year we retire. It's a huge mortality spike that year. We lose our social network. We lose our, you know, reason to get up in the morning. Okinawa has no word for retirement in their traditional language. Instead, a word, ikigai, essentially life purpose, imbues their entire adult life. So there's no sort of artificial punctuation between their productive, meaningful life and their life of repose and, you know, golf down in Arizona or whatever. You know, they continue to be contributors. They continue to wake up and understand that they have a commitment and to their community and to their family, and know that they have to contribute. It's not necessarily working full time, but it's a few hours a day, and you see that into the hundreds among some of these Okinawan people.
It was so interesting to go back to is it Moai?
Yes.
So these are social circles, and you visited one of these circles on the island of Urama, just off of Okinawa's main island, and you met with a number of women who they meet twice a month to pull small amounts of money together, and then they give it to whoever was neediest at the time or just redistribute it. I love the idea of this.
Yeah, so the Moais, a lot of what fueled Moais a century ago, there were no real banks. So in order to have money at time of growing, these Moais came together, and every time they meet, you brought some money and it went into a pool, and then the neediest person got that pool. But it also amounts to sort of a scheduled face-to-face meeting time with people who cared about each other. And the Moais, I visited a few Moais, but they always tend to be people who care about each other. And, you know, I remember one day I sat with five guys who were 102 years old, and they meet every day and they drink sake and they argue about who the hot guy liked them best back in 1942. But when one of the ladies didn't show up, the other four put their kimonos on and shuffled across the village to check on their friend. And, you know, you think about loneliness and older age and long-term care. And man, this is a cultural concept that's just baked into life there. I mean, the care was there and the social support was there and the financial security was there, all in the simple idea of a Moa. Didn't cost the government anything. Didn't cost an employer anything. It's a lesson the rest of us could learn, actually.
Right. In Okinawa, though, you write that things are changing. This is another amazing stat, that as a group, Okinawans are three times more likely to reach the age of 100 than Americans and to have far less disease. Okinawan women get breast cancer at about half the rate as American women, and both sexes have a fraction of the rates of heart disease and dementia from Alzheimer's as people in the U.S. But Okinawa has been slipping away as younger generations abandon the lifestyle of their elders. And then, like so many places around the world, Dan, they've got access to a lot of these fast food restaurants like McDonald's, A&W, Burger King. So what did you find there?
Well, it's sad. In the 23 years I've been traveling to Okinawa, I've seen it go from this beautiful, time-honored culture to being a forest of fast food restaurants. Most of them sprouted originally around the U.S. bases, but now it's just spread like cancer across the island. And at the same time, these massive superhighways have gone in there. So people are increasingly turning to their cars. And you know, when you have cars, people spread out more, so they're less likely to know their neighbor. And now Okinawa is one of the least healthy prefectures in Japan. Mm. So it's gone from the healthiest in the world to the least healthy in Japan. And, you know, in my mind, it's no longer a blue zone. Wow. Not to say you can't go to parts of Okinawa and continue to see the culture and the environment of longevity. And that's what we captured for Netflix. But you increasingly have to go to the hinterlands and among very old people to see it. And it's sad.
Wow, that is really sad. And you write that they even developed a taste for Spam, which is the canned meat introduced by American GIs.
Yes, and that happened long ago. That happened immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, Spam was in the K rations. And during World War II, Okinawa was hammered. Many more deaths among Okinawans than among the American troops. And, you know, they were sort of, they weren't part of Japan. They were also actually the Ryukyu's kingdom just a couple decades earlier. And they were sort of armed with bamboo spears and they went up against American rifles. And, you know, we don't see this side of World War II, but they were really hammered. Just about everybody, especially the women, went through many years of starvation. And we had many stories of these older women who hid in the forest for 2 or 3 years and lived off of, you know, mussels in the rivers and bamboo shoots and nearly starved to death. And then, of course, they emerged and American GI, lots of stories of American GIs being very, after the war, being very kind and, giving them their K rations. And all of a sudden, this salty, fatty, calorically rich, it was like a love bomb for their mouth.
Wow.
And it eventually made its way into their stir fries and became a cultural thing. And, when I first went to Okinawa in 1999, you know, they'd take a piece of Spam the size of a marshmallow and make a huge stir fry out of it. Now when you dump an entire pan and chop that up and it's mostly Spam and very little vegetables, you have, the proportion becomes very negative. Very bad for your health.
Do you think they can turn this around? And did people bring this up on your latest trip there?
They don't even realize it's happening. You have to realize people for years, they've lived centuries of semi-hunger and hardship or discomfort. And then comfort comes and cars and rich, delicious food. Mm-hmm. And that's first seen as progress. And then this is a wonderful thing. And it's not bad at the beginning. But when all of a sudden this glut of comfort and processed, calorically saturated, nutritionally negligible food proliferates, that's when it becomes a problem. And that's what has happened in Okinawa. And it might take a generation for them to figure it out, but geez, the way what we used to have was far better. And America hasn't figured it out yet. We continue to slide
right
in our pursuit of comfort and low cost, calorically rich and delicious foods.
Right. Today, we're speaking with Dan Buettner about his new book, The Blue Zone, Secrets for Living Longer. Dan, we have just about 4 minutes left, so we don't have time to talk about another blue zone, but I hope people can get your book because the photos, once again, are so beautiful and you just learn so much about how other people live and what we can learn from them. Why don't you just talk a little bit about the end of the book, Rules to Live Longer By? Let's go over some of these things. It's all so simple, but it just really needs to be repeated. Things like move naturally, find purpose, eat healthy food, the 80% rule. Can you just talk a little bit about that in our remaining minutes?
Yeah. So the idea behind Secrets of Living Longer was to have a kind of a compendium. The first part of the book brings people up to date on what we've discovered in the Blue Zone in the last 20 years, introduces Singapore. And then most of the book is how to put it to work in your life. And it did have National Geographic photographers along the way. So that's in there. But a lot of these things, we're on this sort of lurch for living longer. Longevity books are on a tear right now. But most of them are kind of promoting stem cells or rapamycin or metformin and anti-aging no-thrums. And there is no proof that any of these work on Americans. Meanwhile, knowing your sense of purpose, taking the time to do the internal inventory, what your values are, what you're good at, and an outlet, worth 8 years. And that's been, several studies have shown it. Taking the time to make good social connections, a group of four or five friends who care about you on a bad day and who have healthy habits, that's worth a half a dozen years of life expectancy over being lonely. So there's a really great time. They're not sexy. They're not, I can't do them overnight, but they all work, and they not only lead to a longer life, they make the journey enjoyable. And I think this Netflix documentary really makes that clearer in a even more powerful way than you know, a book can, even though I like my book.
Right. What are you hearing from people? Because you're reaching so many new people because of the Netflix series.
I feel like, you know, it took me 20 years, but I feel like an overnight success. the documentary has been number one in the world.
Wow.
I thought it was going to end up in the slag heap of, you know, cultural programming or something, but no, it hit a nerve.
My book
is a New York Times bestseller.
It's amazing, Dan. I've gone on social media and so many people are talking about the Live to 100 Netflix series.
Yeah, I just feel like a blind squirrel who found a nut. I'm very happy.
Well, it's great because I think you're reaching a whole new group of people. Well, thank you again, Dan. I think this work is so, so important. Dan Buettner is the founder of the Blue Zones. And this is really an incredible organization that helps Americans live longer, healthier, happier lives. He's written a number of books. His latest is The Blue Zones, Secrets for Living Longer. And I hope you can watch the Netflix series. It's called Live to 100, Secrets of the Blue Zones. And it's on Netflix now. Dan, we would love to have you back to talk about the Netflix series, and we can bring some sound in. So how about we do that in a couple of months?
I'd love to. And in the meanwhile, do not underestimate the power of public radio.
Yes.
I think as far as shaping our minds and shaping our environments, there's no more important public, semi-public institution. So I support what you're doing, and I still appreciate the conversation.
All right. Well, that's so nice of you. Thank you so much, Dan. And thank you for joining us.
I'll see you when you're 100.
All right. healthy at 100. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.